I'm James McIlvenny, and you're listening to the History and Philosophy of the Language Sciences podcast, online at hifilangsci.net. There you can find links and references to all the literature we discuss. In the previous episode, we saw how European scholars around the turn of the 18th to the 19th century took an increasing interest in the deep similarities in words and grammar between the classical languages of India and Europe. The explanation that occurred to European scholars to account for these similarities was to suppose that the languages of India and Europe belonged to a single family, descended from a common ancestor. We noted how Friedrich Schlegel suggested looking to comparative grammar, modeled on comparative anatomy, which would systematically compare the grammatical forms across languages in order to uncover their genealogical relations. In today's episode, we're going to look at how these new impulses in language comparison and history coalesced in the first decades of the 19th century into the university discipline of comparative historical grammar. Although figures like Sir William Jones and Friedrich Schlegel pointed out the similarities between Indian and European languages and suggested the direction research should take, the actual task of systematically comparing forms in detail fell to others. This laborious undertaking was first attempted by the German scholar Franz Bopp. As a pupil in the Gymnasium, that is, an academically oriented German high school, Bopp was carried away by the contemporary enthusiasm for Sanskrit and Oriental learning. Particularly piquing his interest was Schlegel's 1808 Über die Sprache und Weisheit der Indier, which we spoke about in the previous episode. According to the legend, after reading this book, Bopp made it his mission to uncover the relationships between the languages of East and West. Bopp's apprenticeship in Oriental languages took him as a young man to Paris, where he studied alongside August Wilhelm Schlegel, the brother of Friedrich. August Wilhelm was perhaps the more accomplished Sanskritist of the two brothers. He would go on to become the first professor of Sanskrit and Oriental languages in Germany, with his appointment at the University of Bonn in 1818. The product of Bopp's Paris sojourn was his first book, the 1816 Konjugationssystem. The full title in translation is On the Conjugational System of the Sanskrit Language in Comparison with Those of the Greek, Latin, Persian, and German Language. In this book, Bopp analyzed and compared the conjugational systems of the languages named in the title. That is, he examined the inflectional forms of verbs in these languages and used these to chart the historical relationships between the languages. In the following years, Bopp continued his research in London, where he published in 1820, among other texts, a revised English version of the Konjugationssystem, which was called the Analytical Comparison of the Sanskrit, Greek, Latin, and Teutonic Languages. The great innovation in Bopp's work was to unite the philosophical and historical sides of linguistic scholarship, as he described it. The historical element was the empirical language data that many scholars were collecting and curating in this period. In the last episode, we saw the example not only of Friedrich Schlegel, but also the parallel tradition of Adelung and Vater. The philosophical component was the analytic step Bopp took. Although many of Bopp's predecessors highlighted the desirability of analysis, in practice they didn't really do much more than engage in an impressionistic discussion of surface similarities. By contrast, Bopp, for each language, dissected words and factored out changes in form caused by the laws of euphony. For Bopp, euphony was simply a cover term for all the sound changes he observed, a term he didn't really theorize any further. Through this analytic procedure, Bopp arrived at putative underlying forms of words and grammatical inflections that he could then compare like for like across languages. Bopp's decomposition of words follows along the lines of rationalist approaches to the study of language, of which there were several different traditions that were active in his day. One of the most prominent of these traditions, to which Bopp was exposed during his time in Paris, is that of grammaire générale, or general grammar. The general grammarians didn't try to collect data from all the world's languages, but rather sought to subject the grammar of just one language to a logical analysis. The belief was that a proper analysis would uncover the cognitive processes underlying grammatical forms. These underlying processes were assumed to be universal and therefore should be the same for all languages. The work that kicked off the general grammar tradition is the 1660 Grammaire générale et raisonnée, General and Rational Grammar, by Antoine Arnauld and Claude Lancelot, also known as the Port-Royal Grammar, after the Port-Royal Monastery in which the authors lived and worked. The tradition of general grammar continued to exercise an influence well into the 19th century, whether that influence was to serve as a source of inspiration or to trigger an allergic reaction. As we'll see in later episodes, even a few notable linguists in the 20th century appealed to the general grammar tradition. Like the general grammarians, Bopp believed that verbs at base reflect the structure of logical propositions, even if this logical structure may have become obscured in the course of historical language change. On this understanding, each verb must be analyzed as containing a subject term, an attribute that is assigned to the subject, and a copula linking the subject and attribute. In his analyses of verb conjugations, Bopp broke down verbs into the root, corresponding to the idea attributed to the subject, and inflectional endings, which he believed were ultimately derived from the verb to be, the copula. This original structure, he thought, has become obscured over time because of changes effected by the rules of euphony in each language. In recognition of his pioneering research, dissecting and comparing the forms of the Indo-European languages, Bopp was awarded a doctorate from the University of Göttingen in 1820, which opened up the possibility of a university career. In the following year, he was called to an extraordinary professorship for Sanskrit and general linguistics at the Young University of Berlin, and was promoted within 5 years to ordinary professor, the highest and most secure rank in the German academic hierarchy. Bopp's appointment in Berlin was pushed forward by his acquaintance Wilhelm von Humboldt, a key figure in the founding of the University of Berlin and in the wider educational reforms that were implemented in Prussia at this time. Humboldt was himself an influential language scholar. We'll get to know him properly in this connection in the next episode. The institutional foothold Bopp secured in Berlin allowed him to train up a group of students to populate the new field of comparative historical grammar that was taking shape. It also granted him the time and resources to continue his comparative project himself and make it more comprehensive. The chief product of these efforts was his Vergleichende Grammatik, or comparative grammar, of Sanskrit, Zend, a dialect of Persian, Greek, Latin, Lithuanian, Gothic, and German, which appeared in 6 hefty volumes from 1833 to 1852, expanding along the way to include most of the major subgroups of Indo-European languages. The increasing technical focus, or perhaps narrowness, of the approach coalescing around Bopp received some somewhat sarcastic commentary from August Wilhelm Schlegel, who, as professor of Sanskrit and Oriental languages in Bonn, was in a sense Bopp's rival. On Bopp's comparative grammar, Schlegel quipped in 1831, "Der Boppart ist ein Ort am Rhein. Die Boppart sind Pedantereien." That is, Boppart is a place on the Rhine. Bopp's style is pedantry. Bopp's comparative method provided a means for identifying the putative genealogical relationships between languages, but it had very little to say about how the languages have actually changed historically. In the standard narrative, it's another scholar who's credited with putting the historical into comparative historical linguistics. This scholar is Jakob Grimm. Jakob Grimm and his brother Wilhelm Grimm made foundational contributions to the study of law, literature, and language in Germany. Today, the brothers Grimm are perhaps best known for two of their collaborative works. First of all, their collection of German fairy tales, and secondly, their Deutsches Wörterbuch, the first comprehensive dictionary of German that illustrates the histories of individual words with quotations from texts. Linguists remember Jakob Grimm most fondly for a book he wrote on his own, his Deutsche Grammatik, a comparative grammar of the Germanic languages, that is, the subgroup of Indo-European that includes such languages as Dutch, English, many of the Scandinavian languages, and so on. This work, which in its final edition totaled 4 volumes, lays out and systematizes several insights into the historical development of the Germanic languages. From our present-day perspective, the diverse scholarship of the Grimm brothers may seem like contributions to rather distinct branches of learning. But it must be remembered that for the Grimms themselves, their various undertakings were inextricably intertwined. On their understanding, the law, literature, and language were all manifestations of the spirit of the people, the Volksgeist. The broader movement that shaped much of the Grimms' outlook and methodology in this respect is historicism. This was a movement which began around the turn of the 18th to the 19th century, and which is closely related to the Romanticism we already encountered in the last episode. Like Romanticism, historicism was in large part a reaction against the mission of the Enlightenment to remake humanity and human society according to principles derived from pure reason. Perhaps the best way to understand the Grimms' connection to historicism is to examine their relationship to Friedrich Karl von Savigny, one of the leading legal scholars of the period and lecturer in law to the Grimm brothers in their first undergraduate years at the University of Marburg. The association between the Grimms and Savigny lasted their lifetimes and had a deep influence on all of them. Jakob Grimm, in fact, dedicated his Deutsche Grammatik to Savigny, with a foreword written as an open letter to him. A prime illustration of Savigny's historicism is the role he played in the so-called codification controversy that flared up in the wake of the Napoleonic Wars. As is well known, one of the most spectacular careers to be made in the course of the French Revolution was that of Napoleon Bonaparte. After crowning himself Emperor of the French in 1804, Napoleon embarked on the conquest of much of Europe. Many of the German-speaking territories he conquered were organized into the Confederation of the Rhine, a state allied with France and which adopted many of the social and legal reforms emanating from the French Revolution. The French Revolution basked in the sun of the Enlightenment and put into practice in many spheres of life the thoroughgoing rationalization of the world that Enlightenment thinkers advocated. One of these rationalist interventions was the introduction of a single, unified, and above all, explicitly codified system of laws, often referred to as the Code Napoleon. The code was intended as a definitive guide to the law in France, in which judges could simply look up the relevant transgression and mechanically apply the appropriate judgment. The code became the basis of the law in many European countries influenced by revolutionary France, including the Confederation of the Rhine. But Napoleon was ultimately defeated in 1815, and his conservative opponents across Europe sought to impose the old order on the ruins of his empire. The Confederation of the Rhine was broken up and largely absorbed into Prussia. Although many Napoleonic reforms were in fact quite popular, they were in many cases considered untenable under the new Prussian hegemony. In the case of the law, the question arose as to the best replacement for the Code Napoleon. Should the new Prussian provinces develop their own legal code, cleansed of its French character? In the rest of Prussia, there was already a common legal code in force that was in fact slightly older than the Code Napoleon. Or should the states revert to the ancient system of custom, obscure statutes, and historical precedent that was in effect in many of these lands before the French conquest? Savigny emphatically supported the restitution of the old order. He argued that the law was an expression of the particular people that are subject to it, of their Volksgeist. According to Savigny, the law cannot be derived from reason in the abstract, set down in a single document and applied universally. The only legitimate way to practice law is to study its evolution over time. This principle was brought into the center of the Prussian intellectual world when Wilhelm von Humboldt arranged for Savigny to become the first professor of law at the University of Berlin. The historicist spirit manifested and propagated by Savigny animated Jakob and Wilhelm Grimm's own scholarship. The idea that a people's law, literature, and language are all expressions of its Volksgeist is what motivated their studies. Both Grimm brothers also specifically understood their work as a nationalist project directed towards strengthening the self-awareness of the German nation in the face of the division and foreign influence that was felt most acutely during the period of the Napoleonic Wars. The Grimm study of lexicography and grammar grew out of their work on German myths and legends. In trying to reconstruct the correct, original form of tales, they were led to examine word etymologies. But their first efforts at etymology lacked method, They lined up words from different languages and different periods alongside each other and offered explanations for the connections between them that might have seemed superficially plausible but were ultimately quite speculative. The desirability of rigorous principles to constrain these wild etymologies had long been recognized. Friedrich Schlegel, in his Sprache und Weisheit der Indier, had already highlighted the need for strict principles for identifying the correspondence of sounds in words across languages when putting forward etymologies. August Wilhelm Schlegel, who was rapidly taking on the role of the wry conscience of the emerging field, wrote a withering review of the Grimm's freewheeling etymologies. Jakob Grimm he described as an etymological Heraclitus, for whom everything flows, has no fixed form, and is in constant chaotic change. In response to this critique, Jakob Grimm strove for greater rigor in his etymologies. He paid increasing attention to how sounds and grammatical forms change over time without trying to explain these changes by appealing to meaning or culture. One of the most iconic of the many formal rules he proposed in the historic development of the Germanic languages is the one usually referred to in English as Grimm's Law. Grimm noticed a series of sound correspondences that distinguished the Germanic languages as a group from all other Indo-European languages. Very briefly, and to use modern terminology, where other Indo-European languages have voiceless plosives, Germanic languages usually have fricatives. For example, we can see this correspondence when we compare the first sound in the French word poisson with the English fish, or the French word trois with the English word three, French cœur with English heart. Voiced plosives in other Indo-European languages are usually voiceless in the Germanic languages. For example, the first sound in French dix compared to English ten. And the aspirated voiced plosives of Sanskrit are unaspirated in the Germanic languages, as in Sanskrit brater compared to English brother. It's as if these consonantal sounds in the Germanic languages have all shifted following a rule. This rule seems to have then applied a second time in southern varieties of German. This can be seen in many words in modern standard German compared to their English equivalents. Since the sound system of modern standard German is largely based on southern dialects, while English derives historically from northern dialects. The last sound in the German word Schiff is a fricative, while the sound in its English equivalent Ship is a plosive. The same correspondence occurs in the middle consonants of the German words Wasser and Machen compared to English Water and Make. Grimm's law therefore describes a regular historical process in the sound systems of the Germanic languages. Grimm imagined that this process was a manifestation of the Germanic Volksgeist. The practical application of Grimm's law, and other laws of historical sound change, is to guide our etymological reconstructions. For example, we can now say with confidence that French poisson and English fish go back to the same word in the parent language, because the sound laws tell us the precise steps through which they've developed into their modern forms. On the other hand, an etymology that does not accord with the sound laws will have to be rejected, because we have no principled way to show how the words have developed into their modern forms. At this point, we must note that Jakob Grimm was not alone in thinking along these lines. Most notably, the Danish linguist Rasmus Rask, who Grimm was in contact with, observed many of the same sound correspondences that informed Grimm's law. But in the preface to the first volume of his Deutsche Grammatik, Grimm wrote that, unfortunately, he had already sent his book off to the printers before he had a chance to read Rusk's writings on this topic. On the strength of their scholarship, both Grimm brothers were elevated into the academic pantheon being constructed in Berlin. They were both made members of the Prussian Academy of the Sciences in 1841. Through the pioneering work of such scholars as Franz Bopp and Jakob Grimm, in the first half of the 19th century, comparative historical grammar started to become a discipline. The field had clear goals and methods, and crucially, an institutional base. Comparative historical grammar could enter a period of normal science, to use the term introduced by Thomas Kuhn in his 1962 The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. That's to say, a scientific paradigm had solidified in which diligent scholars trained in the field could beaver away on defined tasks. In the next episode, we turn to the alter ego of comparative historical grammar, language classification, an approach that is in many ways the forerunner of present-day efforts at language typology.